Hi, I'm Sanjay, and I'm a serial entrepreneur for the kicks, and I also invest in startups.
And I'm Shannon, a recent college grad working on building my first company.
And this is Startup Days,
the show where we take a behind-the-lens look at starting and growing a company from the perspective of founders and investors.
Today on the podcast, we've got Dennis Hayes, co-founder of Hayes Microcomputer, joining us. Thanks for joining us, Dennis.
Well, it's nice to be back in Technology Park for a change.
Yeah, and this was, and we'll get to it in a minute, but this was formerly the home of Hayes Microcomputer, right?
Well, just down the street a little ways.
Just down the street. Well, first of all, Dennis, tell us, born and raised where?
I was born in Spartanburg, South Carolina.
Okay.
We just had our 50th anniversary Spartanburg High School reunion a couple weeks ago.
Oh, that's awesome.
And that was terrific. In high school, I was fortunate. I was able to graduate with honors. Came in second in the science fair.
What was the project that you had in science fair?
I built a Ruby laser.
A Ruby laser from scratch?
Well, I was fortunate that I was able to buy the Ruby rod with a grant from the National Science Foundation.
Oh,
but,
wow.
My high school physics teacher figured out we could get the Ruby rod, and I put the assembly together and the power supplies to. Then it was a matter, and when you fired it, it would go make a big flash. And it was all too fast to be able to tell whether it was really lazing or not.
Right.
So after a little while, I figured out I could hang a piece of photographic paper at the other end of the hall, go in at night when it was dark, and flash it, and I got a small dot on the photographic paper so I could prove it was actually working.
Wow, that is incredible.
Yeah.
So what brought you down to Georgia then after high school?
Well, I spent a week at Myrtle Beach after graduation, and my friends were going to colleges all over the country, and so we were all kind of competing what's the best school you can get in.
Right.
And I sort of had a technical orientation, and Georgia Tech seemed – it was kind of between Georgia Tech and Clemson, and in that case, Georgia Tech won. Yeah, I thought I wanted to be an electrical engineer and started in EE, but in my first quarter at Georgia Tech, I started learning about computer programming, and then I just wanted to know more about computers in all aspects, hardware, software, how they worked. Everything.
Yeah. So you changed majors while you were there at Georgia Tech?
Yep. From EE to physics.
And that was...
That gave me more time to take computer classes.
Okay. And back in those days, we didn't have a computer engineering or computer science degree?
That's right. That's right.
Okay. So you had to basically just kind of shimmy it in there based on...
It wasn't until Pat Crisine was president and I was on the National Advisory Board that we nudged the university into creating a College of Computing, which has further evolved since then, but created a focus on it because computing is important to every discipline.
Right. So let's talk about that. So while you were at Tech, you spent some time away to kind of pay the bills.
Yeah, I was a co-op student. The first job was with AT&T Long Lines, which was in those days was part of the Bell system before the breakup. And being there for 3 months as a student and finishing your project, I was the only one that figured out how to finish projects in 3 months. The trick to it was to find the old guys that were within a year or two of retirement.
Right.
Because the bureaucracy couldn't fire them that fast if they got in trouble.
Right.
And they would help me by coaching me who to go to, who to see, how the procedures work so I could get a project finished in 3 months.
Oh, wow. Right. So you spent time there, then?
I did a second job with my co-op.
Okay.
And that was with a small company that was at the Peace Treaty Cab Airport. I doubt that it's even there anymore. It was called Aviation Electronics.
Okay.
And it was like a custom design shop on a very small scale, and learned a lot about creative thinking at that job and small business, you know, going from AT&T to a small, to that size of a small business was sort of the extreme ranges of size.
Right.
And then I got to the point where you're supposed to go to school straight for a year, and realized that I wasn't going to have enough money to make that run. So I took a job in Orlando, Florida for 1 year.
Okay.
One of the few times I actually got to use physics with the inertia of the stepping motors and critically damping the stepping motors.
Well, that was the only time that you actually used your physics degree?
That I could think of quickly.
Yeah. So from there, you returned back to school or?
Yes, I went back to school and got close to graduating, but I had two classes left to take and was running short on money again.
Wow. So those last two classes kept you from a Georgia Tech degree?
Well, Dr. Pettit, when he was president, told me I was definitely an alumni, but that, I never actually got a degree, which my mother reminded me of.
So from there, what was your next stop? Did you actually go get a job or? Did you start a company?
No, I went to work for National Data Corporation.
Okay.
And I worked there for 3 years. First job was in a little, it was a small group they had tucked away in a cubby hole somewhere. It only had three engineers in it. And we were kind of the skunk works to fix problems. During that time, they had their first layoff they'd ever had. They operated large call centers in Atlanta, Cherry Hill, Chicago, and Los Angeles, and all those were connected by high-speed modems on lease lines, and they had connections into various banks for credit card processing and that type of thing, where they had a lot of modems, lease line modems, going to different places.
Yeah.
What we found was, well, when they had the layoff, they really managed to upset all the guys that were in their tech control center managing the communications, and seven engineers quit the same day.
Wow.
The only person left was the administrative assistant. And they looked around the company and said, who could do this? And they tapped me to come and fix and put it back together. So they handed me requisition for seven jobs. And I could hire people, but I had to keep everything running and staff it at the same time.
Right.
So a lot of long nights at the beginning. Pretty quickly, I began to realize that a lot of the problems they were having was because preventative maintenance was not being done. And they'd have tuning mechanisms there where you could adjust the frequencies to get them back on frequency. And if you didn't do that every few months, you'd start having data problems. Okay. Well, we figured that out. But then when I really learned the magic of modems,
yes,
was when we were installing billing systems and electric membership cooperatives, where we not only was the electric membership cooperative in a rural area, but they also had usually a rural telephone company, and a lot of times the installer would have never installed a modem before, and so when they'd go out to install the modem, I would convince the toll test board at the phone company to let them call me, and I would walk them through how to get the installation done, and then we'd test it, and then they could leave. Previously, the test they would do, or the installation they would do, didn't get tested, and it wouldn't work, and they'd have to go back three or four times to finally fix it. But that's where I learned in more detail than anyone should ever have to know. The ins and outs of every signal in and out of a modem, what the frequencies do, and just more than you'd ever care to know. But it came in handy later because I took what I'd learned about the microprocessors at Financial Data Sciences and what I learned about the modems at National Data. And as the Altair and MSI computers were coming out in the market, a friend of mine, Dale Hetherington, that helped me start the company, a co-founder, had been in that group of three people hidden in the closet that were the skunk works at National Data. So, and one day he left for the weekend and came back with a motherboard he'd bought at the Dayton Hamfest, and was going to build the first computer he built.
Wow.
And I coached him a little with that, and he learned it very quickly. And then when the Altair and MSI were coming along, we went and joined the Atlanta Area Microcomputer Hobbyist Club, and that was where everybody would bring their homebrew computer and show it to everybody else, or we'd talk about, you know, what's the new chips that are coming out, or what's Commodore doing, or what's Atari doing, and then eventually the Apple II came there. And so our first, we created a kit with a circuit board that made a modem you could plug into the S100 bus, which were the Altair and MSI computers.
So this was this before Hayes was a company, or was it?
Yes.
Okay.
We then used that product to start Hayes Microcomputer Products.
So in essence, you really built an MVP, minimum viable product,
right?
And then did some customer demand, right? You saw people bought this, so you said, hey, there's a market here.
Well,
that's what launched the company. Is that kind of the path?
Yeah, well, at that time, as we first introduced the product, there were just two or three computer stores, so it was a whole new concept, and we thought computer stores are going to be everywhere soon.
Right.
So we did the S100 bus, and at that time, the computer stores were hungry for anything they could sell, and they really liked it if they sold it and it stayed sold because it worked. and our trick to being successful was to make sure it always worked. and they never had to return it.
Okay.
So after we were doing pretty well with the S100 bus modem, we said, okay, what do we do next? The way to grow a business is to have another product.
Right.
So we looked around, and the Apple IIe had just come out. So we did the micro modem II.
Okay.
For the Apple II.
Yep.
And we also certified it to comply with Part 68 so that it could be attached to these new connectors that everybody takes for granted these days that are everywhere.
Because that was when AT&T was still a monopoly, right?
Yeah,
control of everything.
It was still the Bell system.
You're right, okay.
And there was no book on how to do the testing. It was just the requirements you had to meet to pass the FCC. So we said, how do we do this? Well, We've done labs and written up lab reports and treat it like we were doing a lab at college. And so we sat down and defined the problem. You know, in our report, we sat down and defined the problem.
Right.
We figured out test and the equipment needed and put that all in the report. And then we ran the test and took the data and reported the data and then gave the conclusions just like you would with a lab report in chemistry or physics.
So you guys were first-time entrepreneurs doing this, right?
Oh, yeah.
I don't even know if you called yourself entrepreneurs.
I was 27 when we actually incorporated the company.
Okay. What was the thing that you were most worried about in terms of doing all of this, right? Entrepreneurs always have fears about different things. Was there one big overriding fear that you had about this?
Cash flow.
Don't
spend more than you make.
That's an important lesson.
We hit the ground with product ready to sell. I mean, the first day the company was incorporated, we had product to sell. We'd already sold a few.
Right.
And
how did you fund all of that? Did you have outside investors? Did you guys self-fund it?
My partner, Dale, had done another product for amateur radio where he'd made a profit of about $7,000. He contributed that to our new company as the startup funding.
So $7,000 in.
And we bootstrapped. And as we bootstrapped, we didn't take it all out as a profit. We kept a lot of the profit in, and retained earnings helped us build the company.
Did you guys pay yourselves? Was there salaries being paid from the beginning? Or
yeah, but they were modest. They were, you know, they weren't what are we worth. They were what do we have to have to live on?
Right. Yeah.
And of course, once the company got more successful and larger revenues and such, that all got adjusted to be market rates. But
yeah,
it took a few years.
What's the, like, looking back at those early days, there was probably a lot of heartache that happened, a lot of tough nights, tough days, but there was probably a lot of fun. What's, like, the one thing that you remember that was probably the most enjoyable thing that either happened or that you got to do because of having a company?
Ooh. Maybe it was the call from Steve Jobs.
Oh, wow. Asking you to do what?
Well, it started out like, what is this thing you've made to work with our computer? You know, you can't use our name on anything. And we had a chat about that, and I reminded him of the O. Cedar mop case, and asked him to go look that up. And after our conversation, he said, we want you to come to Cupertino and show us what you did. And so that was notable.
Yeah.
And we ended up being good friends.
Yeah. So there was a good partnership then between, I mean, obviously you were making products for Apple computers.
Well, we were making products for the Apple computer market.
Right.
And they bought some, but mostly for their own use. They were it's not like they were buying it from us to sell.
Right.
So we were continuing to develop a channel. When we first introduced the Apple II modem, or the micro modem II for the Apple II.
Right.
As I say it correctly, as I was trained.
I don't think you're going to get sued now at this point. I think you're okay.
Yeah. Well, I like to get it right anyway, so.
Yep.
So as we were getting ready to ship that, there were only about 12 computer stores at that time. So it had gone from like 2 or 3 to like 12 or 15, maybe, if we didn't know about, because it was always hard to find out where they all were.
And that's 12 or 15 across the country?
Across the country.
Wow.
One of them was Wozniak's brother.
Okay.
And
in California.
In California. And that's how Steve found out what we were doing, because we sent a package to each of those stores. And that's how it got to Steve very quickly, and he called me to come show him what we did.
Wow. So long-running, great experience then, from your perspective, at least with Apple, back in those early days.
Well, yeah, and we did software to support the Mac and as well as the PC.
Okay, so moving forward then, so you guys, did you have a relationship with IBM as well in those early PC days?
No, not in the early days. One of my friends at the time when we were first starting the company had a brother who had just gotten his MBA, and we sat down and told him what we were doing. And he said, you must be crazy. You're trying to compete with IBM and AT&T at the same time. At the time, I said, it's okay. It's going to take them a long time to even know what we're doing. We're not on their radar.
Yeah.
And that was true.
Yeah.
Eventually, we were. And eventually we had to deal with patent licenses and cross licenses. But by that time we had some of our own patents that they were using. So it came out pretty well. I managed to get cross license for every patent AT&T had and every patent IBM had. And they got a license to our patents, which at the time we had one that was really important. And I had maybe three or four that were not nearly so important.
Do you feel like that is a necessary trait for entrepreneurs, to be kind of blissfully ignorant as to how hard the job is that they're about to face in doing a startup? Like, did you actually realize how difficult the trek was?
It's like being blissfully naive when you start to go to Georgia Tech. you graduate from high school and think you're so smart because you're got honors and recognized for knowing a lot about science, and when you the first day at Tech you meet everybody else and you realize, hey, they're just like me. It was tough, but if you can survive it and thrive on it, it's good for you.
Yeah.
But it's not for everybody. You're going to have a tough life for a few years. You're going to learn a lot that's useful and a lot more that's not really useful.
And in your estimation, is the same thing true of being an entrepreneur? That
you got to be willing to take a fair amount of abuse. You're going to have to learn how to work well with people that you may or may not like, whether they're employees or suppliers or investors or in any category. And you're going to have to learn how to do your job, because there's no way you could learn how to do what your job is going to be next year from just going to college.
Right.
You got to learn it on the job training.
Yeah.
But also continue to supplement that on the job by continuing education of some kind. Go to seminars, go to classes, meet with other entrepreneurs, learn from everybody that you can learn from.
So is there one kind of last parting piece of advice you'd like to give to entrepreneurs that might be listening to this?
Well, that's part of it. Learn from everybody.
Okay.
Do things right the first time. You'll never have time to come back and fix it. Make sure your product is high quality, because if you ship defects, they'll get sent back and you'll get buried in them. Things like that. I could probably go on for a week or two, but it's you know, it's an interesting experience to have done those things. After the company, I've spent a number of years coaching or advising early stage or growth companies. Learning how to manage rapid growth is difficult.
Right.
But you got to be able to take a risk. You got to, when you know it's going to happen, when you really believe it's going to happen, you got to be able to put it out there and risk it. And that may cause some sleepless nights. It may cause your friends to question your sanity. But it's when it works well. But it doesn't always work. I would also say you learn more from your mistakes than you do your successes. So always keep learning. Try not to make the same mistake. But if you can learn the mistake from someone who made it in the past, you can avoid making it as well.
Dennis, we appreciate you being on the podcast. As somebody that had a Hayes modem as my second modem, I appreciate the products that y'all put out that let me learn about talking to other people and connecting in the BBS days, which I don't think anybody nowadays knows about. It's been great to have you on.
That was before we had the internet, and number of independent operators set up bulletin board systems where they could exchange data.
Exactly. Again, thanks for being on the podcast, Dennis. We appreciate it.
Well, thank you. I hope I can come back early next year and tell you about what we're working on going forward.
Absolutely. Anytime, we'd love to have you back.
Okay. Thank you.